This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the Congo Civil War broke out in 1997, my guest Emmanuel Dangalo was a professor of chemistry and dean of Brazzaville University in the capital of the Congo Republic. Dangalo is also one of his country's best-known novelists. His books have criticized, even mocked, the corruption in his country's government. He's a friend of such American writers as Philip Roth and William Styron. They were instrumental in getting him and his family out of danger after the start of the Civil War and bringing them to the United States, where Dangalo is now a visiting professor at Simon's Rock of Bard College. He studied in the U.S. and France in the 60s and 70s. He's now president of the Congolese chapter of PEN, the International Writers Organization. Two of his books have just been translated from French to English and published in the United States, The Fire of Origins and Little Boys Come from the Stars. When the Civil War in his country started, Dangalo was actually in Connecticut visiting friends. He immediately set out for home to find his family. They had fled the fighting in Brazzaville. One of his daughters had disappeared.
The youngest daughter, who was 13, was taken away by the French because the French army came in to for the evacuation of its citizen. And she was playing with a French friend. And so when they came, they just took her with the other French citizen. And 2 weeks later, I found out that she was in Chad, I mean, thousands of miles away. And then we have to fight another 2 weeks to have her sent back to the Congo. It was really complicated.
It must be crazy when nearly everybody is dislocated. You know, when everybody has fled from home, when there's no food, when families mm-hmm. all over the country have been separated.
Yeah, it's a very strange feeling. I mean, you leave a country which was functioning more or less normally, and then when you come back, everything is real chaos. You can't find anything. I mean, you wonder whether you're dreaming or is it reality.
In the meantime, there were search parties looking for you, and one group of people looking for you was headed up by the writer Philip Roth, who you had met several years earlier. How did they find you?
Well, when they found out that I was in danger, they tried to get me out. It was very, very complicated. It was very, first, it was very difficult to locate me because I was first in a small village, then I moved to Pointe Noire, and it's amazing because in all this chaos, one of the things which worked was the email to Pointe Noire. I don't know how we got there. And it's from there that I finally slowly rode back, took the train and walk and buses and cars and anything to get and boat to get to Kinshasa on the other side of the river to the American embassy.
And the way you got to the United States is you were invited to teach at Simon's Rock College at Bard, where you're now a visiting professor of chemistry. If it wasn't for that, would you still be in Africa?
Oh, yes. And I'm very lucky because of these people who helped me. I have many friends who were trapped there. Some were killed by, stray bullets and things like that. And I'm very lucky because not only I managed to get out, but I came with my family. And Simon's Rock College of Bard and all these people, they were very generous of getting me here.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Emmanuel Dangalo. He's a novelist from the Congo. He's also a professor of chemistry. He's been living in the United States since 1997 when civil war broke out in his country. He's also the president of the Congolese chapter of PEN, the International Writers Organization. His latest novel translated into English is called Little Boys Come from the Stars. What was Brazzaville like when you were growing up, when the Congo was still ruled by the French?
Well, Brazzaville was a small colonial city, but it has its hour of glory because Brazzaville is known in French history. It's a part of the Gaullist, De Gaulle's epic, because during the war it was the capital of the Free French for a while. So Brazzaville is known for that. So it was a small town with lots of French people, And it was the capital of what used to be called the French Equatorial Africa. And so they had the one lycée, high school, for all of French Equatorial Africa. And that's where I went to school. On the other side of the river was Kinshasa, which was the Belgian Congo. So these two capitals were really rivals in a way. The French were showing off on one side and the Belgian on the other side.
Did the Africans and the French mingle much?
Well, no. The French lived in the center of the city and the African in the periphery. But the strange thing was that, contrary to the Belgian colony, which was on the other side, the French and the Africans went to the same lycée, the same school, the same education. But that was the thinking of the French, because for them, everybody has to be French. Civilization is French. So they wanted to make us little Frenchmen. And also, we were learning history of France, and we were saying, like a little Frenchman in France, that our ancestors were Gauls, you know, the Gauls. Yes.
So to tell us more about the good parts and the bad parts of the French education you received.
The good part was that we had the same education that they had in France. We took the same exam, at least at the level of lycée. It's called lycée, high school. And but the bad part was that, contrary to, let's say, the British colonization, which let the people use their own language, and which is known as indirect rule, the French rule was, on the contrary, everything has to be French. So you couldn't speak your own language. Your history doesn't exist. Nothing exists until the French civilization came and saved you and brought you to light. See, this is it.
Your father was a teacher. Did he teach in the French system?
Yes, my father was a school teacher, one of the very few Africans who were teaching. Yes, all education was done in French, so he was teaching in French, as I say. In the Belgian colony, the Africans were taught in the local language, Lingala. But in the French part of Africa, everything was done in French.
How did the world around you change in 1960 after the Congo got independence from France?
Ah, yes. It was quite exhilarating because we thought that finally history was on our side. We were going to change the world. We were marching forward, and it was quite something, which is quite different from what happened on the other side of the Congo, in other words, the Belgian Congo, which is later Zaire, where the Belgian did not have... did not educate any African. At the time of their independence, there was only one university-educated African. But on our side, we are lots of educated people. Not very highly educated, but people who took power were people, the generation of my father, who were school teachers. And there were a couple of doctors. So for us, really, history was on our side. We were going to change the world.
What were your expectations of the new Africa and the new Congo?
Very high, very high. And it was this time we were thinking of a united Africa within 10 years. And within 10 years, Africa would be very rich, not and a developed country. And really, it's amazing. And we were all revolutionaries. And we had leaders who also inspired us then. We had people like Nkrumah, like Nyerere of Tanzania. We were looking up to all these people.
You say that you studied chemistry because you believe that science and technology would be very important to the new Africa and you wanted to contribute.
Yes. Yes, it's in all this dream that we're going to change Africa. We need scientists, engineers, doctors, and all that. So that's when I went into science.
And you came to the United States to study on a Ford Foundation scholarship. What year did you come to the States?
I came to the United States, I think it was 61, under President Kennedy. President Kennedy was president. And I came, I was the first, in the first group of African from the former French colony to come to the United States, because up to then, all of us, after the high school degree, which is called the baccalauréat, we all went directly to study in France. So my group was the first one ever from French-speaking Africa to come study in the United States.
And you came at a time where you were very idealistic. You know, your country had just gotten its freedom. You had all these hopes for the new Africa. Here you were studying in the United States so you could go home and contribute. And go ahead.
I would like to add, not only that, yes, we're very idealistic, and we came here in the United States in the 60s. You know, they were here also. There was this huge freedom movement, Martin Luther King, the Freedom Rides. I lived through all this, so it was really quite an exhilarating time for me.
Did you experience segregation in the United States? And I'm wondering how that...
Oh, yes.
How did that compare to what you were used to in Africa?
Quite different, because in Africa, in the colonial rule, it was my country, so the French were really a minority. So I didn't. If you didn't go to the quarters, you wouldn't feel that discrimination. But the first time I really confronted the discrimination was here in the United States. One summer, I was asked to teach French to a group of young American were going to the Peace Corps, since they were going to French-speaking Africa. So I was teaching, I think it was down in Carbondale. Yes. So I walked into a restaurant, you know, I wanted to go. I walked into a restaurant, and as I approached the restaurant, I saw at the back a black person who was working in it, who came out in front of me and asked me not to go in. I said, why? You know, I never confronted this type of thing. He said, don't go in. I think they want to serve you. I said, no, don't worry. I have my money. So, and then he was, he didn't know what to say. And so he went back to the kitchen. And then I walked in and, you know, this guy, big, tall white guy came in front and said that I wouldn't go in. And I really didn't understand. I mean, so I just turned back. This is my first real confrontation with the segregation back then in the 60s.
My guest is Congolese writer Emmanuel Dongala. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Congolese novelist Emmanuel Dongala. He fled the Congo Republic at the start of the Civil War in 1997. He had been dean of Brazzaville University, where he taught chemistry. He's now teaching in the U.S. You spent a lot of time in the West. You left the Congo in 1961. You came to the United States. You studied at two colleges. You got your master's degree or degrees here. And then you went to France, and you got two PhDs there.
Yes.
By the time you returned to your country, it was 1979.
Yeah, right.
What was the state of the government? Go ahead.
Well, by then, the dream really has petered out, you know, like a raisin in the sun. And by then, all this idealistic dream we had faded. And when I went back to the country, it was a one-party system. With the military dictatorship, with the official ideology of Marxist-Leninism, you know, modeled on the Soviet Union and China. So it was really far, far from what we thought Africa would be in 10, 20 years. So there was no freedom of expression. And not only that, the economy has started going downwards. So it was really not what I expected at all.
Had you ever believed in Marxism in an idealistic way before seeing how it was practiced in your country?
Well, it was in the air of the time, you know, our generation. In the 60s, the 70s, we were all socialists. Maybe not rigorously Marxist, Leninist, but socialist at least. And we have all the theories about African socialism, with leaders like Nyerere, Nkrumah, who believed in it, and all the war of liberation, which were still going on. We were dreaming of a socialist world. But then, when you talk ideally about socialist, and then when you live in a country under a Marxist-Leninist dictatorship, it's really quite different.
You came back home in 1979. I know you had a book of short stories published in 1982. When did you start to write fiction, and why did you start to do it? You were trained as a chemist. You were teaching chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but I always read. I remember my father was a teacher, so we had lots of books around, not real great books, but you know, things, even things like catalog. It was just something to look at them. And then when I was in the lycée, I read a lot, all the French writers and all that. Strangely enough, was at Oberlin College, it was in English, my first short story. So, and then I kept on and kept on. And then when I published that book, actually I finished it when I was in Brazzaville, and it was immediately banned by the socialist, the Marxist government.
Why?
Because I was making fun of them. It was very funny. At first they didn't know, because they even read it, and then they realized that, you know, it was about them. So not only they banned the book, they went to the French Cultural Center and took it from the shelves, you know. And then a very strange thing happened. They called all my friends at the state security to ask questions about me, what we were plotting and all that. And strangely enough, they didn't call me. I didn't know why. It's only very late that I understood why they didn't call me.
Why?
Well, it's because many of the state security men were trained by the Stasi, which is the secret police in East Germany, and the Securitate in Romania. And the tactic was, they don't hit you directly. They just, you know, threaten your friends. And then you get panicked. And when you get panicked, you will do something. But since I didn't plot anything, I just wrote a collection of short stories, they couldn't find anything. So,
did this give you a sense of power that you didn't think you had? That you were,
oh, yes.
That you were so important?
Yeah, not me. But what gave me the sense of power is writing. That's where I knew that the words in Africa, words are very powerful, very powerful. You can kill somebody with a word, and even in our culture, as a matter of fact, don't say a bad thing about somebody, because if you keep saying that bad thing, it might turn into something real and hit him. And I found out that writing is very, a word can make a regime panic. I find myself powerful, not as me, Dongala, but as a writer.
Emmanuel Dongala will be back in the second half of the show. His latest novel, Little Boys Come from the Stars, has just been published in the U.S. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Congolese novelist Emmanuel Dongala. He fled the Congo Republic after the start of the Civil War in 1997. He had been a professor of chemistry and dean of Brazzaville University in the capital of the Congo Republic. He's now a visiting professor of chemistry and African literature at Simon's Rock of Bard College in the United States. His novels have dealt with colonialism and post-colonial corruption. Two of his novels have just been published in the U.S. Well, in your latest novel, which was just translated into English, Little Boys Come from the Stars, the main character's uncle becomes very important in the local government. And he kind of like rises to the top of the local government. And he uses his power in very corrupt ways. In fact, I'm going to ask you to read a paragraph on page 75 that gives an example of how corrupt he's become in his use of power.
Okay. Here's the uncle speaking. "But, my dear, the party runs the state, and besides, I am the personal representative of the President of the Republic. I think you still don't understand, brother-in-law. I have become the most important individual in this village, this district, this prefecture. Everything has to go through me, especially the major work that has to be done to mark the great ceremony that's just on the horizon. I have absolute power. You want to supply cement, bricks, boards for a new building in town? You need my signature. You want to supply stacks of paper, pens, and furniture for some offices? My signature. Your business wants to participate in the construction of the stadium where the ceremonies will take place? My signature. And a signature is expensive."
Is that what it was like? Is that an accurate example of typical local corruption?
Absolutely, yes.
Now, in your novel, it's the main character's uncle who is, you know, like the local godfather. In your life, when you got back to the Congo, did you have any relatives or friends who were in positions of power and who had become very corrupt?
Well, not relatives, but friends, yes. And the sad thing was that some of those friends were the friends with whom we were discussing, you know, all this idealistic revolution, how to change Africa. But as soon as they got there, they went into the political machine and they became as corrupt as the rest. Because the government for them was not a way of working for the people, working for the for society, but government was just a mean get rich oneself.
You know, in your novel, there's a lot of like big buildings and extravagances, you know, that get built as a way of as a way for the local corrupt officials to just amass a lot of money. Did that happen in your town, that a lot of things got built?
Yes. Uh-huh. Lots of things. This is what called white elephants, you know, these huge projects with lots of money and which do not serve at anything. They put lots of money in it. The people in the country put it in their pocket, and then there's nothing done on the ground.
Can you give us an example of a couple of white elephants from your hometown?
I think it's the Russian who wanted to build a mining company because we have some manganese there. They built a huge factory which never worked. Many socialist countries, you know, were helped by the Soviet Union. And I remember, I think it was in Guinea, when the Soviet Union exported lots of snow plows in the country. And they didn't know there were no snow in those countries. There are lots of white elephants like that in Africa.
Was it very disillusioning to see the corruption in your government and to see all of your friends, all your formerly idealistic friends who had become corrupt? Because at this point, you couldn't blame the imperialists. It was like the people from your own country who were responsible for it.
Yeah, it's...
You could still blame the imperialists.
Yeah, but no, this is the problem. After a while, you get to a point when everything is not the fault of the imperialist anymore. You see, you have to get to that point. And I think now we have gotten to that point. Even though the imperialists are still there, you know, like what happened in my country, it's essentially a battle for oil because the Congo is, in Africa, is one of the biggest producers of oil. So, but the problem is You have to be to accept to be corrupted. So this is our own responsibility.
In your novel, one of the political leaders says imperialism is the cause of our malaria and our AIDS. Do you think that some of the local leaders used imperialism in the colonial past as a way to cover up for their own sins?
Oh, yes, indeed. They've been doing that
Not that the local leaders are responsible for malaria. But what I mean is that imperialism just became the kind of excuse for everything. Yeah.
Right, right. And then in the 90s, it became democracy. You have to have a multi-party system so that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, would help you. So they create parties, which are not really parties, you see. They go with the change of the time. The corrupt people, they know how to adapt, you know. Now, all they talk is, it's not socialism anymore. It's not Marxism, Leninism anymore. Now it's democracy, multi-party system. So can you imagine that we went from one single party to about 70 parties within 2 months? So,
right.
And this is a game.
Yeah, in your book you write, after slavery, colonialism, neocolonialism, and scientific socialism, democracy descended upon us one August morning. And so, yeah, you make it seem like it's it's not really democracy. It's just another form of everything that's come before.
Right. And the funny thing is that those people now, they say they are Democrat. Not a single one of them have ever been for Marxism, Leninism, never been for socialism, etc. They were always been good Democrats.
Which, of course, you're saying that sarcastically.
Yeah, absolutely,
right.
Yes.
Okay. So as a writer, were there things that were demanded of you? You know, like you read that paragraph in which the corrupt official has to sign everything, and of course you have to pay for his signature, so he gets a take of absolutely everything that happens in the town. As a writer, in order to get published, did you have to pay off anybody? Or were you expected to, were their hands being held out to you for payoffs?
No, as a writer?
Yeah.
No.
Just to get published or to get distributed, to get into bookstores?
Well, we have no publishing houses there. No, what was happening? Yeah, every time you publish a book, it's the censure, the banning of the book. That's the main problem. So, and you can get arrested for the book you've written. So, this is why many people wrote under pseudonyms. But I didn't want to write under an assumed name. I wrote under my own name. Maybe this is what saved me, actually.
Why? How would that have saved you?
Well, because I was there in the country. I didn't hide. I said I wrote the book. And so they didn't find any excuses. Because usually people who write in hiding, it's very easy to accuse them of plotting to overthrow the government, of things of this kind. But then I came up front and I say, I am writing this book, very critical, and I'm living in the country. That made it different, I think.
My guest is Congolese writer Emmanuel Dongala. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Congolese novelist Emmanuel Dongala. He fled the Congo Republic at the start of the Civil War in 1997. He's now teaching in the U.S. Do the local languages have written languages, and is there much literature in those local languages?
This is the problem, because, you know, we come from a very oral tradition, orality. So the local languages do not have a written history. So now there's a plan to write these languages. But the problem is you have to transcribe them to find the correct sound. Some of the sounds we have no equivalent in the Western languages. In other words, in Latin letters we use to transcribe the languages. So, and also, it's very strange, for instance, the same language, because you know that the colonial boundaries are very artificial. So, a same language can be spoken in the French part of the country or the Portuguese part of the country, and the transcription is not the same. So, for instance, in the French part, the sound OU is written O-U, while the same sound in the British or former British colony is the letter U. So people have to agree on how to transcribe the language, how to pronounce it, how to invent new signs for the sounds which do not exist in the Western language. So it's a long, long fight.
It seems to me that you have friends who have, you know, died for freedom, and you also have friends who have died pointlessly, who have just, like, died in the crossfire or died, mm-hmm. you know, died.
Oh, yes. I mean, in a situation of chaotic like it was during the Civil War, you go on the road, you have roadblocks, you have, you know, kids, you know, gun-toting kids, 13, 14, 15, and they ask you for money, and I've seen lots of stupid things. For instance, if they ask you for money, give 100 francs, which is about 25 cents. If you don't have it, they can shoot you. And sometimes if somebody else's wants to pay for you, they get mad and they shoot the person very pointlessly. I thought as an intellectual, I knew what violence was. I've seen it in movies. I read lots of theoretical books. But when you relive real violence in front of you, really, you're completely lost. You don't know what to do. Sometimes you're very courageous. You do things which later you think it's foolish because you might have killed. Sometimes you're just a coward. You just sit there. You're watching an act of violence. You're a coward. You try to hide yourself. You say, "Ooh, I'm lucky it's not happening on me." So that's where I found the limit of the intellectual, confidence. I was very confident. You know, I knew what violence were, that I would stand against this. If I see somebody brutalized, I would intervene. Well, I always didn't do it.
It sounds like you've been surprised both by your acts of courage and your acts of cowardice.
Yes. And sometimes what you do, you think it's courage, but afterwards you say, well, it was really foolhardy. I could have been killed.
What's an example of that?
Well, an example of that was in one of those roadblocks. We were with a friend. We saw an old woman was being beaten because she didn't have any money. And my friend just jumped to the neck of that boy and you really push him and he was, and then the other pointed the gun at him to shoot him. And I was sitting there just watching, and I wanted to do it. I really wanted to do it. But then when I saw my friend with gun pointing at him, ready to shoot, I say, well, you better just keep quiet. And after that, I was really ashamed. But on the other hand, I've done also acts which are very courageous. But when I did it, I didn't think it was courageous. I just did it like that without thinking.
So what happened to your friend at the checkpoint?
Well, they took him away. They took him behind the house, and they say, "You're going to have a little trip," and I never saw his body again. I just heard the shot. That's all.
Oh, they did kill him.
Oh yes.
Oh. And did that make you more scared about going through checkpoints? I mean, it's a very...
It's a
frightening and sobering experience, I'd imagine.
It was not the first time. I've seen it several times. So I sort of... Sometimes you get used to horror,
Right.
So, and you didn't have any choice.
Right.
It's the only road you could take. So,
what about an example of us of an act of courage that surprised you?
I was arrested once again. One of the roadblocks. I had roadblocks, and it was in how can I put it? An enemy territory. Well, it's a militia who was behind some ethnic leader, and before you cross the roadblock, they ask you to speak the native language, tribal language. And I did not speak that language. So they stopped me. They say, okay, speak these languages. And then I really got mad. And then I said, what do you think you are? You think you've done more for this country than me? You know who I am? And you know, I really spoke and then just pushed the roadblock and walked through it. And they were just standing there looking at me walking by. Yeah. But as soon as I turned the corner, I started running.
Had you planned that at all, or did it just come out?
Not at all. It just came out like that. That's what I said. Really, in a case of violence, you really don't know what your reaction would be.
Now, you know, you've said that you studied chemistry because you thought science and technology would be important to the new Africa. And now you're teaching chemistry at an American college, living more or less in temporary exile from the Congo. What does chemistry mean to you now? How much do you care about it? And do you care about it in ways that are different than the ways that you expected?
Well, let me tell you first about my first experience when I got into a classroom at Simon's Rock. You see, I used to teach chemistry there. The library was very poor. Students do not have textbooks.
In the Congo.
Yeah, in Congo. So, you know, they rely a lot on the teacher. So if you miss a hydrogen someplace, you know, they'll carry it all their life. Right. So when I got to Simon's Rock, the first day I entered that class, I had a textbook. And then I looked around, all the students had textbooks. So I got panicked. I said, well, they have the textbook. I have the textbook. What am I going to do? I've never been in that situation. But it took me about a week or so to find out that they didn't always understand everything they read in the textbooks. And that's where the teacher comes in. So, and then my teaching changed. Instead of teaching everything as I used to do, the easy things, I make them read them, and then the difficult thing, I explain. So this is very, this has changed my teaching. So chemistry for me is very important because it keeps me alert on the science level, and it gets me also away a little bit from politics, which I have sometimes I'm fed up with.
Do you think you'll be going back to your home in the Congo anytime soon?
Yeah, I hope so. But what I'll do, maybe I go just for a visit first and see how things are.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Emmanuel Dangala is now a visiting professor at Simon's Rock of Bard College. His latest novel, Little Boys Come from the Stars, has just been translated into English and published in the States. So has his 1987 novel, The Fire of Origins. This is Fresh Air.